Welcome to the Minivate Gang Podcast, episode, I don't know, 127, 128?
Somewhere in there, yeah.
Somewhere in there. We're at the Unsummit in St. Paul at Coco MSB. I'm Steve Borsch, and I am sitting next to...
Meg Knodel.
And...
Julio Ojeda Zapata.
And...
Michael Robentine.
And...
your lovely and talented host, Phil Wilson.
And Tim Elliott and Graham Thickens couldn't make it. Tim is, I don't know, doing what, Lang Sod. And I don't know.
Green sign up.
Yeah, yeah. And unusually, we're at Unsummit and sweaty because it's unusually warm in here today.
I'm telling you, it's a global, you know, it's climates of the world. It's a theme, climates of the world. So
right.
whatever floor you're on, you get a different climate of the world. So
yeah, it's I brought a sweatshirt and I've been putting it on, taking it off.
Tropical theme, yeah. The floor we're on. So
yeah, exactly. I should have worn my Tommy Bahama.
Well, there you go.
So Meg, you started off, you were telling a story about the weakness of your two colleagues on Summit, Don
Ball
and Michael
Robentine. Meg and Michael Robentine and Don Ball put on Unsummit.
That's
here
right.
At Coco MSP.
That's
so
right.
Meg, do tell.
Well, this is our fifth Unsummit, and I'm really proud that we've held this event four other times, that we've made it to a fifth. Don and
get
Michael
to the dirt. Get to the dirt.
Are all. Like the big brothers I've always wanted.
Oh.
We all have our character flaws, and they all come through in planning. We all have our strengths, and hopefully they show to our participants.
And in terms of Don and Michael, which side do they fall on? More strengths or more weaknesses?
Well, I would say that Michael pushes me out of my comfort zone far more than I care to admit.
Okay.
Well, Don is really laid back and just kind of goes with the flow. And great,
adapt.
Graciously, Michael's wife and two small children came and did all the setup.
Well, he was at
last
home.
Night with
he was taking a nap in the corner.
Michael directed traffic and told us what to do.
Wow. That's fabulous.
It is.
And how old's your daughter?
Two.
And you made
six
her do
six and nine.
And you said, honey,
that would explain why the signs are hung so low. So.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
And why the one on the fifth floor is quite so crumpled.
And Julio, I was a little bit bummed out that we didn't have a Skype live into the Unsummit 5 today. No, I'm kidding. Because you've done twice now that I've seen. You've done really fabulous, where you had John Bremen that time and then Leo Laporte the other time Which was that?
Was
a locker conference.
That was a locker conference.
Yeah.
And then I brought in guests via Skype. That was quite a technical achievement. It's a lot easier now with the iPad too. So at the time there was a lot of technical heavy lifting.
Did you know that Julio really can't have a conversation without mentioning the iPad at some point in time?
Well, that's because he does. iPad means business.
That's exactly right. So,
the
but
new,
you know,
new book.
I've noticed that. I gotta give you one of my iPads.
That in
every once in a while, his wife says, "Julio, when you're in the shower, please leave your iPad out on the counter."
Exactly. Listen, let's talk a little bit about Unsummit and today's theme, which has come together. So, guys, who wants to kind of tackle that? Meg, go ahead.
Well, I think that mentioning Michael's family coming and helping, I think family has really been a theme for me so far throughout the day. Ginger Buckland talked about a family foundation she's creating around family and technology. Kirk Horsted, who I heard speak, talked about his make your breakaway theme, which included things about kids and how they're embracing technology or not, moving out of the home or staying at home, how the economy is changing that. And also, the first session I went to, which was Star Trek versus Star Wars, there were some interesting conversations about intergenerational differences in that particular session. So this coming together has definitely spanned a lot of different topics.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. On that same topic, we have a session coming up with Teresa Boardman and Kay
Loire
on the generational differences in terms of social media perceptions. Both of them are older women. Well, no, they are.
I'm so
trying to
make them listen.
They're probably younger than I am,
that
Michael.
No, but that was where the discussion came from. They both, on a fairly regular basis are met with disbelief that they're active in social media because of their age. And they're not that old, but they're older than the perceived demographic. So their
right,
session
right.
is exploring that from a bunch of different viewpoints.
I think the generational thing is it was very relevant or apparent in the Star Trek, Star Wars. Obviously, we've changed the world with the thinking there that was going on in that deal. But
of course,
quite frankly, I was a little uncomfortable. that I was in that room and enjoying it. That was what I was really uncomfortable about. But it was really
was
kind
fun.
Of fun was to see that we were talking about Star Wars and Star Trek, and depending on how old you were, was which Star Wars and which Star Trek are you talking about? I mean, Meg, how old were you when Star Wars, the original Star Wars, came out?
That was 1977, and I was 2.
So,
ouch.
It's precious.
Yeah.
So, anyway, it was very, very apparent. But
I actually took a date to tell you how old I was.
That was the last date he had, as a matter of fact. So
That's right. She said, oh, he's a geek.
Yeah, the Star Wars versus Star Trek session, which was this wonderful nerd fest. It was wonderful. But I was talking about how my son is now obsessed with Star Wars and Star Trek, and how I've pondered whether that's genetic or whether he's doing it just because the old man does it. But the differences are very interesting because he loves all the Star Wars prequels. He loves Jar Jar Binks. And I'm looking at this kid and, wondering, what the hell are you smoking, kid?
What's so wrong?
Yeah, so wrong. But it's just interesting that we share these interests, yet they're, all of this stuff, the younger generation just perceives it differently. He thinks the prequels are just wonderful.
So I'm curious, and again, this is anecdotal, of course, mm-hmm. but do you guys share content? I mean, does he ever say, Dad, you've got to watch this video? Or, because my son's doing that all the time. He said, oh, my God, Dad, look at the new Batman trailer. And I said, oh, there's new Batman movies? He says, no, it's a game. But look at it. And he made me watch it. I couldn't do it right then, but he made me watch it. And it is cinematic, and it looks real. It looks like actual human beings. And I would never have looked at that. I never would have come across my radar screen unless he had asked me to watch it. And so we're sharing a lot of content. And I'm wondering, I'll go to their session, because I'm wondering if they're finding that the stuff we're paying attention to is different. Mm-hmm. Because it used to be we'd all kind of watch the same TV shows, or in the old days listen to the same radio programs, or we'd read the same newspaper.
The old days, listening to the same radio program? Okay, you and I are in that battle. Come on.
I'm not saying us. I'm just generically. Right.
But
the Waltons, you were referring to the Waltons.
Right. Yeah. But that's been the thing that I've been really interested in is how long it takes, for example, for memes to hit the Daily Show, and that time is seeming to shrink now. Mm-hmm. And the demographics that watch the Daily Show, I mean, there are people that are 70 years old watching it, down to 20. Watching the Daily Show, and
which has become a source for news for a lot of people,
right.
Which I think is okay if you're educated enough, knowing what the news items of the day are and mm-hmm. what the real facts are. But I mean, I think that a program like the Daily Show exposes people that wouldn't necessarily be interested in current events to some extent to that situation. So because I mean, we talk a lot about it came up in Susan's was it Susan? No, it came up in a discussion about. News finding you. You know, the days of us going searching out and finding news. Now news finds us. So, really interesting stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of validity to that. Julio, when you look at technology, are you looking at... Because, I read all your stuff and I see some of this and I see some of the insights that you gain, especially around the books, for example, but not just, this app is cool and it can do these things, or the device is cool and it can do these things, but the two together, and what does that mean, and how is that changing people's work, personal workflow, or how they're paying attention, and so on. What kinds of feedback do you get from people like, the 20-something that's in here, or as Michael described, Teresa Boardman and the other woman that'll do the session, a little bit older. Do you get feedback on the columns about those insights, or people want to know more, or they want you to get deeper, or they want you to shift how you're...
Well, as a newspaper journalist, I'm in a really interesting place because the feedback I get will range all the way from some 60-year-old guy handwriting me a letter, putting a stamp on the envelope and sending it in. Wow. To a regular flow of emails, to increasingly social media feedback. I have a system set up where if somebody follows me on Twitter, I'll automatically follow them back. And the reason I do that, there's no way I can keep up with 12,000 followers, but the reason I do that is because I never know which of those 12,000 followers I will want to have a fruitful DM conversation with. So I've set it up so that I can engage in a conversation with anyone at any time.
We do that very same thing at the library for privacy purposes, so someone can ask a private question if they have a reference question. Because increasingly they're asking reference questions in a public space rather than wanting to tiptoe up to the librarian and slip a little piece of paper across the desk.
Interesting. What are they asking you in the library that is so private?
Health questions, questions about divorce, mortgage, debt.
Wow.
You know, there are a variety of really personal things. Interesting. Politics that they don't want other people to know what their politics are.
So, Phil, when you want to ask about Kama Sutra, you can now DM the library.
Maybe Meg will answer.
Meg will definitely answer. Because Meg is the one who monitors that account.
Listen, the question Julio, let me ask you, you mentioned as somebody who works for a newspaper, do you still consider yourself working for a newspaper? Or, are there more eyes on the St. Paul Pioneer Press online or on paper?
Those two worlds are increasingly merging. I say I'm a newspaper reporter, but I'll make a confession. Entire weeks may go by without me touching newspaper.
In print, yeah.
Yeah, right. I don't read newspapers that way anymore. I just don't. I think of myself as a newspaper reporter, but in a cyber sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Pioneer Press is just an example of a newspaper. It's somewhat hindered in this regard because its website right now is, it sucks. Our Pioneer Press website sucks, but we're working on an entirely new website, and that will accelerate the process. The Pioneer Press increasingly will become a virtual community instead of just a static repository of copy. So
I think it's interesting that we're seeing the merging or the coming together. The merging of media now. I mean, we found it, as you guys know from my background in radio. Radio is increasingly merging into not necessarily a radio company, but a media company, providing content for not only on air, but online and to some extent in print. You see the newsprint media is more online. Traditional television is now more online. So I think we're getting more and more away from we're a television company or a newspaper company to we're a media company.
Well, do you remember me talking about this interview that I did for one of my clients with Dries Buytaert, the guy that founded Drupal, and he's over in the Netherlands. And then
with a name like Dries, I hope.
Yeah. And then maybe 2 weeks later, there was a video from WordCamp San Francisco from Matt Mullenweg, who founded WordPress. Both of them said basically the identical thing, which was about their respective platforms, is that we all need to think about ourselves as media companies.
Right.
Or individual media producers, because all of us now are communicating with audio and video and print, and we're encapsulating content stories that people are sharing and shifting around. So we need to think about that happening, and shift the way that we're approaching how we communicate with everyone, our friends, our family, our clients, our prospects, etc. And that was one of the things that came up here. I loved Susan Campion's presentation on business and art, mm-hmm. and artists working together. And you, Michael, specifically about being in the design space as you are aware of graphic designers, for example, being so focused on pixel level precision. And geez, if something's off by 3 pixels, you can't. Joe Average is not going to know why the site doesn't look good. But there's something not right. It's because your unconscious sees that the design isn't quite right, or that it's not fitting quite right, and so on.
I can't imagine anybody would ever say that about one of your sites, Mike.
Not yours.
No, not one of mine.
No. But that was one of the things that came up, and I haven't been to every session. Is there a lot of that kind of discussion going on? Are people talking about, you know, design and delivery of content, or?
I think so. I mean, it's as a designer, it's a really interesting place to be right now, because the tools are so accessible to your average person to bypass designers completely in a way that actually produces fairly decent results for a change. In the past, you could, of course, bypass a designer and you get a crummy looking product as an outcome. But as the tools get smarter and the technology, for lack of a better word, the how of the website moves further and further back into the background, and it's just this amazing looking thing that, well, I don't know how it works, but it's really neat, and my site has it, and it's actually a decent feature, and the user is responding to it. It puts us in a really interesting position. So yeah, that's a conversation that comes up quite a bit. And there is still that clinging to the past of the print designers, because their industry is kind of at a flat line in terms of, there aren't any, you know, amazing cutting-edge new, or maybe there are, cutting-edge new die-cut systems, or, you know, the print process for color printing is pretty much the same as it has been for the past couple decades, at least. Now that everything's been computerized in terms of the equipment they use. So it's I come across that quite a bit with conversations with designers in those worlds.
You know what's really fascinating about you bringing that up about print is, when I was at Apple in the 90s, I managed the pre-press space. And so all the pre-press shops and the printers and all of that were under my purview. And at that point, we did a lot with the Printing Industry of Minnesota, which is part of the Printing Industry of America, a huge trade organization. And I remember, I can't remember the president's name, but he was so proud and touting the fact that there were 55,000 people in printing and publishing in the state of Minnesota and that were part of the organization. And they had something like, you know, 4,000 member companies and so on and so forth. So fast forward, I'm involved in something where I thought, you know, I don't know how many people are in printing and publishing anymore. So I called and got the woman who's the new general manager for Printing Industry of Minnesota, told her why I was calling and introduced myself, you know, Minnovate and blah, blah, blah. And I said, so here's what the numbers used to be. What are they today? And she said, oh, well, we have just under 20,000 members, and we have about somewhere between 1,200 and 1,400 member companies. And I thought, oh my God,
wow.
That's mm-hmm. been 12, that's 12 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's how dramatic the internet shift has been in 12 years,
yeah.
Is essentially it put an industry out of business.
Oh, absolutely. And what constantly amazes me is this shift in perspective. I'm dealing, I say this like it's this big impressive thing. I'm not looking down on these print designers, but there
Snub.
Is. No, I mean, I'm always in the position, whether I'm freelancing or through my full-time work, where I'm dealing with print designers who have no concept of the formats I'm working in, the resolution I'm dealing with. So I'll constantly be back updating their stuff that they send me. They'll, you know, I need an image. Can I have this image so I can put it on the web?
They send you a CMYK TIFF, 300
giant resolution file. They have no concept, but it's my job to know all their stuff so I can fix it and make it right for the web. I was sitting in on a session at the Nerdery the other day, and they were talking about people getting Photoshop filtered layers for web projects that don't work on the web, but they work in print. And again, it falls to the web designer to kind of figure out a way around this, and it's usually having to recreate the asset. So I think, of course, I mean, the newspaper industry is a target all the time. People saying, oh, there's an industry that's on its way out. But at least there's innovation in that space. As you're talking about, you're working on a brand new concept for your site. There's a will to at least try to find relevance in many industries. But when it comes to print, print design, there are these blinders on that they don't want to innovate. They're just so clung to it. And that's why they're going to be obsolete. That's one that's definitely, you know, they already are.
I mean,
yeah,
if you figure that, okay, so where are those 35,000 people that used to be part of printing industry? I mean, what now? A lot of those, admittedly, were people running presses and, you know, involved in shipping Time Magazine out of is it Waseca? Is that where the Time plant, the Business Week and all that? Yeah. So clearly a lot of those people were that. But I personally know many designers and people that were art directors and everything mm-hmm. else in the print world that are yeah. now painting houses.
Well, let's take it, you know, obviously we hear a lot about the economic situation in the U.S. and economic situation globally, probably more than we all want to hear, but because of the 24-hour news cycle. But if we take a look and take this to a little larger level, that the impact that the innovation and technology space has had on our economy from a worker standpoint. I mean, you think about the more that we do without, for example, the more we do without paper, the more we do online and we do virtually, we don't use as much paper. That means the paper industry, the lumber industry, the industries that support the lumber industry, all of a sudden are losing jobs. So, you know, how do we as innovators and the people that are responsible for innovating and moving technology forward and making our lives easier, you know, what is our responsibility for helping those people that are being pushed out by that to bring them back into the tent? Where do we go there?
As a curator of dead trees, you know, as the person who works with books primarily in the room, I would say my entire industry is shifting, and our difficulty is that the container and the content are no longer one and the same. So I want to serve people who don't have access to information, people who don't have access to technology, and a public workstation was a good solution for about 20 years. But devices are becoming more and more personal, and e-readers and tablet computers, which I think will eventually replace e-readers entirely as just the vehicle for that.
Because the e-readers get more robust than the
tablets become e-readers. Right, it's all going to be one device. But how do I serve a community where half is going to be on an e-reader and the other half is going to be reading the dead tree? So
okay, excuse me for interrupting on that point, because one thing I'm curious about. Scientific American back in the early 90s had this magazine cover that had all these different media storage technologies, you know, 5 1/4 inch floppies and all this other stuff, and saying basically all this stuff's obsolete, right?
Right.
And now fast forward, the Stuart Butterfield, the guy that founded Flickr with his wife Katarina Fake, mm-hmm. sold it to Yahoo, he was giving a talk, and this is several years ago, where he talked about how someday you'll go searching for your photos and they'll all be labeled DSC_some number. And that's a problem. So it's a problem when everything is digital, because I have zip cartridges, jazz drives, I have 3.5 inch floppies sitting in my office closet. I can't read any of them.
But you also may have photos from a previous generation that you can look at
and scan in.
And you can drive certain things. However, you don't know who the people in the photos are. Yeah. I mean, having metadata is
correct.
Having metadata.
Right, right.
Whether or not you have it with the asset or not, you know, it's the same value. Ultimately, it's a photograph. Whether it's called DSC_something, or whether or not you were able to talk to a family member who was able to tell you who was in the photograph.
But my point, though, is that how much of the stuff is going to be lost? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's the thing, is that if it's not stored, somebody's hard drive crashes and it's got the only video of grandma on it, and it's gone now.
In the same way that fires took out photographs.
Well, you're right.
In the same way, I think that a lot of times, what we're inadvertently doing is fetishizing formats. That it goes back to...
Sounds
juicy. You blew my mind!
You didn't see this coming, huh?
No, I got it, man.
Ultimately, there are people who are LP people, and they love their LP, and they say there is a sound that comes out of that record player that would not come out of any other device.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's called a crack and a pop.
People have the same kind of physical attachment to books, for example, to photographs, to photo albums. And it's really just about the attachment to that item and not about losing the format or losing the value. The intrinsic value is still there in another format.
And it can be shared. And to your point, anybody can put metadata on a photo by tagging it and so forth. And
I really miss that VHS tape. Right. That VHS tape did so much for my life. I could push in the little button and you couldn't record over it. And, you know, I mean, you wouldn't hear people talking about VHS tapes that way.
Right.
But you hear them talking about books. I love the smell of a book. I can fold over the pages. It makes me happy to write in the margins. You know, it's not, it's the format.
That's a very interesting point. My perception of what a book is has evolved very, very drastically just within the past year. My mindset until very recently was nothing beats a hardcover book. Just the experience of reading a hardcover book is just cannot be matched. That was kind of my mindset. I was kind of old-fashioned that way. But some very interesting things are starting to happen, like the St. Paul Public Library just joined the OverDrive system, where you can borrow books electronically. You're borrowing it for a finite period of time.
Yep.
You're doing it right on your device.
Right.
And it suddenly dawned on me, you know, it's kind of, you know, it, the St. Paul Public Library, the central branch, it's a nice building and all, but it's kind of a pain to have to walk all the way over there. And lately I've been borrowing all my books on the iPad, and I've been doing much more reading than I do in the past.
Notice the iPad reference, just throw it.
And it's remarkable, and there have been some interesting apps coming out. Like, for instance, I can't remember the name of it, but there's a new app from England that collects thousands of 19th century books. That were all scanned in their original format, and you're just reading it as if you're reading an old book.
Oh, yeah, I've seen, I just saw that. I don't have my iPad here, but it's the BBC app.
And so my love affair with the book continues, but it's shifting.
Mm-hmm.
Just within the past year, it suddenly underwent this very rapid, very dramatic shift, where my perception, I love the book, quote marks, but my perception of what a book is and how I interact with the book is suddenly starting to rapidly evolve.
You know, that's actually a great point, because you know what I just thought about as you were just describing that was, I remember going to the Central Library to look for a resource book, and this was probably in the 80s, and going through the card catalog and just thinking to myself, oh my God, this is so inefficient. Then fast forward to the 90s, and I'm on CompuServe, and I was paying gateways as a fee to access their database, and I remember getting a bill one month for $435, and I thought my wife was going to rip my head off. She was so mad, like, are you insane? I go, yeah, but look at all this stuff. I got everything I needed for this research report. Well, yeah, but you could have gotten your butt over to the Hill Library, and then I would go over to the Hill Library, and then, you know, and but I have to print everything out and take it with me and all that. Then fast forward when the net hit, and a lot of these databases started appearing on the net, and they were like nickels and dimes in comparison. All of a sudden, it's like, I'm not paying anything now for a lot of this, for a lot of the stuff that I used to buy through these databases.
And you can IM the librarian and email results and get full text right there on the spot. But I will say, remember when the VHS tape had the like slip-on cover?
Oh,
would
you
stop?
Will you stop it?
I just love the fact that Steve brought up the word CompuServe. I hadn't heard the word CompuServe in forever. Listen, let's kind of come back a little bit to Unsummit, and let me ask you. You know, Don, as Don was always talking.
Oh, I was supposed to do a Don impersonation.
Oh, there you go. As Don had sort of evolved his thinking on what, you know, his vision of Unsummit was, and you guys started working together. You wanted to move a little bit farther away from marketing and social media and just sort of general overall innovation and
technology plus business plus community.
So do you feel that Unsummit 5 is closer to that than Unsummit 4 was? Or
I do, although I don't think it's any secret that Don still wishes that it would be further away from marketing. Marketing and social media, you could probably sum up, we didn't this time around have a big planning meeting before this on Summit, but in the past, we'd always get together, the three of us, and we'd talk about topics, and we'd talk about how we wanted to change the format, and what experiments we wanted to try with this or that, and it would always come back to Don saying, well, can't we talk about something other than social media? I'm tired of social media. year after year after year. And I, you know, I totally respect that. We still have those same conversations.
Well, yeah, let me bring that up. Because we talk, we hear always about, you know, well, there are sessions today about what's a social media expert and the stigma of being a social media expert. There is all of these issues with, is social media a fad? Is social media, you know, those of us that deal with it every day or interact with it in some way, shape, or form, are we tired of hearing about it simply because, well, we just don't know it as that anymore? We just know it as communication?
Well, I think that's part of it. I mean, I've seen more calls this year for changing definitions, I think, than in the past few years. But, you know, can't we just...
Well, we used to call it new media.
Right, right. Then, you know, can't we just call it media? Can't we, you know, take the social out and everything? And
I prefer to refer to the old stuff as legacy media now.
Nice.
Oh, I kind of just call
like,
it media.
Like VHS tapes. Things.
And the cover that slips.
Like newspapers and television.
Well, no, and that's, I think it's one thing to get caught up in the language, and I've never necessarily been stopped by that.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that we're in a unique space in this city, in this industry, being this close to the front edge of adoption. Guarantees that we're going to be talking about that the general public is going to be talking about this long after we're over it, quote unquote. So I think that's part of it. I think that burnout happens because we've done this. We've had these discussions. It's blown our mind already. So it's only natural that there's this lag before the public buys that new phone or tries that new social network that we owe. Well, mm-hmm. I was on that the second day of South by Southwest. I'm past that. Well. You know, this is the type of thing. But I think it for me personally, it all goes back to the fact that this is a fundamental shift in communications,
mm-hmm.
and we'll look back on this being the turning point. However, far forward we look,
mm-hmm.
so that to me makes it easier to you know, as the wave after wave of wave, the ripples get smaller and smaller as all these things fully infiltrate mm-hmm. society. I think people will just become more aware of that. So.
That's a really good point. I'll tell you a story that illustrates that point. My mother lives in New Hampshire, and I'm able to log into her computer from afar to do maintenance and stuff. And so one day I logged onto her computer, opened her mail app, and then I, using the RSS feature in mail app, I subscribed her to all my blogs and all my feeds. And this is great. My mom will be able to sort of keep up with all my social media activity, all my blogging. And for a year, it didn't happen. She never looked at the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I thought it was completely wasted exercise. My mother, she just doesn't get it. And then, just about a year in, this was just last week, out of the blue, my mom said, oh, that blog post about you getting these,
oh, really?
These nerdy paintings put on your homebox as well. That was a great post.
Let her see your post about the Star Wars versus Star Trek. She'll just go, what the?
Yeah.
What did I do wrong?
And it was sort of like, click. My mother, she's just, my mother just shifted. Yeah. She just...
That's actually pretty cool. Well, as long as you don't get an email from her saying, oh, by the way, I took a hacking class at the senior center and I hacked into your webcam, and you got to stop doing that when you're at the desk.
Actually, I was wondering if you would remote into my mother's computer and make sure
right,
it's up to date, because I think helping your family with, we'll bring you right back down to come together and the
right,
family
yeah,
thing.
Right, exactly.
Helping your family with technology is one of the hardest audiences you can have.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mother lives in this remote New Hampshire village that just got broadband, which is why I was able to do that.
That's
so.
Great.
Let's get outside the building here a little bit. Julio, what's been going on? What are you seeing developing in the last week to 10 days that has caught your eye in the technology space?
Well, right now, you know, you've already talked about iCloud and all of that, and I'm sort of thinking a little broader. I'm in a Google versus Apple mindset. Partly because Google and Apple have different approaches to the cloud, which are very interesting, and they, in many ways, they're diametrically opposed. And I'm coming at this as a technology writer, and also coming at it as a user, because until very recently, I was all about Google services.
Right.
I love Apple hardware;
right.
Very sexy. But when I need to get online and get stuff done and monitor feeds and so forth, it's been Google, 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 Google all the way.
Mm-hmm.
But now, and Apple has, until now, I've perceived it as completely incompetent when it comes to this online stuff. And
then you see iCloud.
And something just clicked with some of the stuff that Apple announced, and it's like suddenly I'm very conflicted about what my tools are going to be in the future. I never ever thought in a million years I'd ever want to use Pages for anything.
Well, you know, you...
But suddenly, just being able to, like, start working on a document here and then pick up over here.
Yeah.
That's all Google Docs.
Yeah.
But
Google. Well, and then AirPlay built into everything. And, oh, by the way, with an iPad 2, you can push the AirPlay button. It goes to the Apple TV. And now you're actually mirroring your iPad 2 to your HDTV.
Yeah.
And how huge is that?
It's interesting you say that, you know, because we talked about iCloud last week, and we did spend a great deal of time on some of those features. And as we were talking about it, I was thinking to myself, you know, I haven't heard from Google. I haven't gotten my Google Music, is that what we're calling it? And this week I got the invitation to Google Music. I was like, I was really kind of unplussed because I look at the features that we talked. You know, you mentioned the version of the iCloud as opposed to Google Music. Google, once again, not quite ready for prime time with this service, throwing it out there, trying to, you know, see if something will tick. And then you look at iCloud and realize, you know, the iTunes Match and all of this, all of these features that are now available will be available instantly. So. Okay.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to find out what you were feeling.
And that's another example where I'm very conflicted because I have my entire music collection stored in the Google Cloud right now, but at the same time the iCloud stuff is very interesting. So
Meg's got to go.
Yeah.
She's got a service to run.
I wanted to ask you if you are podcasting next week.
Yes.
Next weekend.
Yes.
I would love to give you a call from the American Library Association convention where 3M is unveiling a new e-reader.
Oh really?
And we'll look at new e-reader products.
Oh, cool. We'll do it Friday morning. When are you going to be there?
I probably won't have any news for you until Sunday, so maybe we can talk.
Well, maybe we can even do an interview. We can just jump on Skype and...
Fantastic.
We can chat a little bit.
Yeah.
That'd be kind of
fun.
Well, thank you, Michael Roventin, Julio Hayden-Zapata, and Meg.
So we're done. We just...
Canole.
If Meg leaves, that's it. We're done. We can't keep going, even if Meg leaves.
I think we should all get to it.
I think we should get to
some sessions, Phil.
That's my thought. I have other things to say.
Plus, you know what? Rivulets of sweat are running down my... It is so hot in here.
Before we go, I did want to discuss just briefly, because we have in this forum talked a little bit about innovation and the initial public offering, which we talked about LinkedIn. Pandora's initial public offering went live this week. And right now, those that bought Pandora stock are underwater because it went up and it came right back down. Is that, you know, from your guys... you know, Steve, obviously,
a great
deal of experience in the first quote-unquote tech bubble.
Happens very frequently where stocks will go up first day. Everybody cashes out, including the those who are managing portfolios for senators and congressmen. And then the stocks drop.
I detected just a brief bit of cynicism there.
Just a bit. but then, in all seriousness, then the reality starts to take off.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to know where things are at.
Well, I mean,
I like the fact that there are actual tech IPOs going on.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's very exciting to see that. But the question is, was Pandora overvalued when it went up? Is that company overvalued? Is LinkedIn overvalued? And your guys' thoughts? What do you guys think? I mean, Pandora hasn't made any money yet. They have not generated profit.
I pay for Pandora because I want the better quality, and I listen to Pandora constantly. I've got my iPhone plugged in the car, and when I'm at my desk, when I don't have to be on calls and all that, I've got Pandora running in the background all the time.
But from a Wall Street viewpoint, from as reliant as our economy is, me on the economy again, is on Wall Street, is it good for Wall Street to have overvalued companies trading?
No, of course not, but I don't think it's overvalued. I mean, I haven't looked at the financials, but when you think about their opportunity to make money in the streaming space, they're the ones with the brand. And so, you know, Apple will do a lot, obviously, going forward here, and there's other streaming competition and so forth, so maybe the market will be really fragmented, but...
But there's a possibility that current trends will leave Pandora behind.
It's possible if somebody can replicate their ability to essentially match what's happening in a specific artist genre. Because I love that. I discover new artists
constantly. And that's what they're built on. That was the concept that...
That was the value prop right there.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And the way they made money, not necessarily profit, but by simply monetizing that after a point, so you get more of that exact same thing, that set them apart. They didn't have to add any bells and whistles. I mean, they're essentially the same as they were.
Well, I think the concern from a business standpoint in doing music online, and I have, you know, a very high interest in music online and generating revenue from that, whether it's for a business or whether it's for the artist or performer, the struggle that Pandora has, as with every online music entity, is the concept of scale. The costs do not go down as use goes up.
Correct.
So and it's that's always a difficult situation to be in. So you can, you know, the more people you have listening, great, but the more expense you have because of it. And, you know, will a company like that ever be able to get to a point of we're making money?
And it won't be able, it won't have the resources to create a data center like the one Apple created or the other data centers that Google has all over the place. So, I'm just talking out of my butt here, but sure. Pandora seems to be an acquisition target.
Well, it could be, but also, you know, in terms of data centers, a great point in terms of being a real competitive advantage for larger companies with bigger war chests of cash. But Apple, for example, their second data center that's going to go online is one that they're leasing in California.
Interesting.
So I forget the name of the company. In fact, I'll try to put it in the show notes. But they're a company that builds data centers strictly wholesale. That's all they do. I mean, you can't, as a retail quote-unquote customer developer, you can't do it. You've got to go in and lease a big chunk of the data center itself, and then you own that. I mean, you've leased it.
Well, they also have substantial licensing fees, too.
Yeah.
That are going to be unique to
which is the cost, the cost
right,
piece.
Exactly.
The cost piece is not necessarily where that music's coming from. It's how do we pay for that music.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
What I believe it's a third of SoundExchange revenue comes from Pandora.
Yeah.
You know, and SoundExchange is the government-appointed entity that oversees the charging of all of these fees for internet and online performance. So, you know, that's a lot of money.
Well,
that's a lot of money.
I think that we should just simply have a new tax, and every human in the world needs to pay $100 a month, and then we can have all this unlimited. What do you think? Of course, I'm kidding.
You're asking. You're a notoriously cheap bastard. So I know. Well, listen. What's coming up in the next week? We've got WordPress has got a meeting coming up
on Thursday. Yep.
Social media breakfast on Friday.
And the topic is
career maintenance.
Maintenance. Okay.
Paul Bettings did a session, I think it's almost 2 years now, way too long, that people
are
still talking about for job seekers. We want to bring him on a little broader topic. So he's going to target people who are job seekers, freelancers, or full-time employees to talk about, you know, and no matter what your situation is, the recession is giving us a wake-up call that we all need to kind of optimize our careers and tweak them so that we're ready if the floor falls out from under us or if we're just getting ready to leap or a situation occurs where we have to leap right away.
There's a, I have to be very careful here, but I'm going to find out if I can disclose something before next Friday, which is a major organization that's going to do something with a new online organization because, in their view, the resume is dead. It's gone.
Yeah.
And we're going to see a huge, when this firm does it, it's going to give instant credibility.
That's really kind of smacks of business card too, doesn't it?
No, it's a global firm.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. So anyway.
So there you go.
All right. Thanks, gentlemen, for being in. And
always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
We'll see you on the next Minivate Gang podcast.